Okay. So today we're planning to continue with our discussion about vertex models. And I thought I would just start with a recap of what we talked about last time, sort of leading into where we want to go. So here's a very quick recap. So just to remind you, what did we do? We sort of fixed, in a sense, like spins. So recall, we're going to associate something to some sort of two-dimensional lattice. And we're fixing the allowed values of spin, which are going to sit on the edges, to be some, say, labels from 1 to n. And we also fixed some Boltzmann weights. See, I want to make sure I get these conventions right this time. So I, J, K, L, which are some sort of, you know, something like related to the energy at each vertex locally. And again, around each vertex, we've got our four edges. So the way we wanted to do it was I to K, J to L. That. And really, we as we were talking about it near the end of the last lecture, we want to think of this as a linear transformation. So that's going to be sort of the recurring theme throughout. So we think of this as a linear operator, which goes from sort of the a copy of Cn sends another copy to the same thing. Where you can sort of think of left going to right, top going to bottom. So this is kind of left, right, up and down. Right. Which is given on the sort of pure states just by this number, whatever it is. Okay. In a way, so this is sort of helpful notation if you like. You could sort of orient this a little bit and think of really going left to right, top to bottom. That'll be helpful in a moment. So, and then a little bit more generally, we define some other linear operators, which are built out of these pitchers and partition functions and so on, which were what we were calling monodromy matrices, which I think maybe introduced some confusion given that there's a few things called monodromy matrices, but that's OK. So we had some. Monodromy matrix, I'll write it as M, I, J. And this depends on choosing how many sort of time slices there are. So this is going to be associated with some vertical pitcher, if you recall, sort of where I is at the top and J is at the bottom. Sorry to change I and J to vertical. But and if there's sort of K lines, then this goes from Cn tensor k times to itself, right? And maybe one way to write it a little bit differently. So we said we'll have it defined as some partition function, but how else might we write that? So if we fix some sort of incoming state, so let me write it this way now. So I don't really want to do it. I don't want to introduce too much conflicting notation. Say. So I'm going to fix k values for the spins. In other words, just like yesterday, we're going to fix some spins on the edges over here. Then we want to we can apply this operator to this vector. And we can look at matrix coefficients, so we can pair with a dual vector, say, where we put some other spin labels. That. So that's a matrix coefficient of this. And what we said last time is, let me just sort of sloppily write this. This is going to be the partition function for the same sort of pitcher, but again, with the spins kind of Oh, sorry, okay. L1, LK, J, M1, MK. Right. And we never really got to why we're bothering with that. So let me try and say that now. Namely, one of our goals might be, so something like, if we're given, or let's rephrase it this way, compute the partition function instead of something like a larger lattice. So this is just one where there's only one vertical line, but what if we added more, right? And one thing we could do is just fix some boundary on the sides. So we talked about a couple different boundary conditions. If you recall, one is periodic, where we just demand that the spin here equals the one here, and so on. But the other thing we could do is just, let me get the notation here again, right? Fix spins on all the edges. So how many do we want to do? What did I use? K, L. Running out of letters. R. So let's imagine that there are R vertical lines, and just like there, we could still have L1, L2 to LK, M1, M2 to MK. So fix the outer spins values, and then try to compute the partition function. So that means, again, we're just allowing arbitrary spins everywhere else, and we sort of sum over all those. So one question you might ask is, this kind of looks like that. Here we had one column. Here we have R columns. Is there some relationship? And that, the answer is yes. So maybe question's the wrong way to phrase this, but this is also a matrix coefficient. So let me write it. And then elaborate. So it's actually a big product of monodromy matrices. Kind of long. Okay. What's going on? Here, maybe I should give a second to write. This monodromy matrix is some map from sort of the left-hand side to the right-hand side, right? If you like to think of it that way. So what's happening here, and the reason for the order, is you're starting with the L's on the left. Once you apply a single monodromy matrix, you're sort of ending up in the middle here. Then you can apply the next monodromy matrix and end up in the third, and so on. You go all the way down, and then you can pair it with the dual. And you can check that this does work out. So somehow we're using different ways of composing matrices now. Last time, this monodromy matrix itself is some composition vertically. Now we're composing horizontally also. But that's OK. So this monodromy matrix actually encodes quite a bit of information. It encodes, namely, any partition function which looks like that, so long as we know all those matrices, which we might hope to. Is that clear? I haven't written down the proof of this, but I hope the intuition is maybe clear. I would recommend trying, for example, computing something like the partition function for the case when there's just one horizontal line and, say, two vertical lines. So if we put I1 and I2 here, and I guess there's only L and M, we're supposed to sort of see something involving one monodromy matrix and then the next one. So give that a try if you like, or take my word for it. Great.
Z is a function of that, or?
I mean to say the partition function for this particular arrangement. So I know. Sorry, not the best notation. Does that make sense? So that's just some number, actually, right? Remember, the partition function for your lattice with boundary or whatever you fix is just a number, and that's what we're saying. So this is some number Likewise, that's some number associated to this arrangement, a configuration, sorry. Any other questions? That's a little confusing. There's a lot of indices and stuff. Okay. The other thing that we discussed very briefly at the very end was the transfer matrix. And the transfer matrix is going to be more of a recurring theme in this talk. So this is, again, sort of associated to a picture with k lines. So this is some t, which is just a sum of monodromy matrices, I from 1 to n. And then you take the monodromy matrix with I and j both being equal. So this is also, it's just a sum of a bunch of linear operators. So this looks like also a linear operator. And you might ask, does it have any interpretation related to computing partition functions? And in this case, it does. It So one thing to point out is that the monodromy matrix depended on fixing the boundary sort of spatially at the both ends. Here, we didn't fix it, but we kind of forced that it was periodic, right? We forced that the top and bottom were equal. And so I don't know what to call this, but fact. Another exercise in linear algebra is that if you want to now compute the partition function for, now we don't fix the top and bottom, but we demand that it's periodic instead. So this thing, but doubly periodic. Boundary conditions. So we can compute that too. In this case, it's actually a trace instead. So this is, I need to say how many. So here there's k. Here, just like before, I'll call this r. So
doubly periodic means it's also periodic in the time direction?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's right. So this value must equal here and so on. Yeah, top horizontally and vertically. So we have a linear transformation on this vector space. You can compute its trace. So that's where this will take place. So as an operator on here. And actually, the thing to take is t to the power r. Fact is the wrong word. Oh, well. So again, it sort of makes sense intuitively. We didn't actually fix the boundary conditions. We just demanded periodicity. Tracing is a lot like demanding periodicity. So that's why it works out. But any questions about that? So okay, sort of an extended recap, but this is what I meant to talk about last time too, and never got there. Okay. Great. So now let's talk about something maybe a little bit more interesting, which is getting more to the heart of integrability, why we're actually talking about this example, which is about the Yang-Baxter equation. And commuting transfer matrices. Hard to underline. So what will that be about? So this is still fitting in the framework we've been discussing with one, well, a couple of modifications, which let's discuss now. So considering a vertex model, but where the Boltzmann weights, these b's, depend on some other parameter, which I'll call z. So a priori, I'm not saying where Z is. You could think it's a complex number if you like, or real. We'll denote these by instead of using B, they use the more standard notation, which is R, I, J, K, L, and then sort of Z, instead of B, so. These are usually called R matrices, maybe people already know that. And let me just make sure I get all the assumptions right. Assume that there's this symmetry. So if we take this R matrix, we can actually swap the order of these indices. So J, I, L, K, but at the cost of negating Z. And to complicate things slightly more, we're going to add more labels to our diagrams. Oops. Thought I'd give up on using all three this time. I don't know how to do it properly. So the extra information that we're going to add is that each one of the horizontal and vertical lines in our lattice will carry some z, so some extra parameter. So in addition to the spin, there's some real number or complex number associated to each one. So given a picture like so make sure I actually label these. So just like before, we've got I, J, K, L. Now this horizontal line will carry a number, say Z1. So it's sort of the same on the whole line. And likewise, this vertical line could carry a number Z2. Then we can associate a weight using the R matrix, which incorporates all this, which will be I, J, K, L, but then involving both Z1 and Z2. So it's this difference. Make sense? That may seem artificial, but it does prove very useful to do this. Maybe one thing to point out, for example, is this sort of relation here tells you that you can reflect a diagram about the kind of diagonal. So just to be somewhat more precise, so each horizontal vertical line in the lattice that we started with may carry an additional label. Z, say Zi or something, depending on which line it is. So pictorially, just for example, maybe we have Z1, Z1, and so on. We can also consider things where there's just no labels on parts. So in other words, we could take the label to be zero. So you could think that maybe there's like a Z4 here, but we're sort of like taking Z5 to be zero, in which case you just won't write it. So that will frequently be our convention. In fact, is that the horizontal lines will not carry a label at all. But let's just keep it for now. OK. Any questions? Great. Then. Then we can talk about the Yang-Baxter equation. Well, strictly speaking, we could talk about the Yang-Baxter equation without these extra parameters, but we're talking about the inner vector equation with parameters. We say that our matrix satisfies the Yang-Baxter equation, probably many of you have seen before, if the following two configurations coincide. So coincides, maybe a slightly wrong word, i.e. have the same partition function. So okay, and what are they? Let me maybe try to use some color. I don't know. Let me know if purple and orange is good or not, but not that many colors today, it seems. Okay, so what are we supposed to do? So it's actually a triangle, which you might argue violates our square lattice condition, but we kind of need it. So here's one, and this should be equal to, so I'm going to add some labels in a moment. We should get the same thing if we sort of slide this horizontal line past, or equivalently slide any of the lines past. So imagine the same thing, but just slightly shifted. I did that right. Yes, I think so. Okay. And okay. This is where it's helpful to add the orientations. So
the lines look almost the same.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Maybe I can do something else.
Maybe a double line somewhere?
Yeah, fair. Maybe I'll go double and triple. Which one's most visible, I guess, is the question.
I mean, I think it's just...
Or they're just all...
I can see the lines, but it's just like the colors are all... I think the white and the purple...
Are the probably...
The same. The orange is, I think, fine.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. I meant to bring red and blue, but I forgot. Yeah. Sorry, this is where it's a little helpful to orient the lines. In the sense that which corner of this vertex here, which still has four edges coming around it, right? Which one is the top one and so on? Well, here it's exactly what you might think, but just to be clear, there's sort of an orientation of everything. So I hope that makes sense. This. And then there's just a ton of variables for this. So so let's just do it. So the horizontal diagonal line is labeled by z1. The other diagonal line is labeled by z2. The horizontal is z3. And it should not matter what boundary condition you put around. So if we just choose some ij, follow Kevin's indices here. He kindly provided C, B. Did I miss anything? No. So we're going to fix actually I, J, K, A, B, C. So let me say for any fixed I, J, K, A, B, C spins. Okay, and then the same labels over here. Z1, Z1, Z2, Z2, Z3, Z3. With the same spin labels on edges. So if I can keep track of that. I, J, K, A, B, C. clear. So again, although this is not a square lattice picture, computing the partition still partition function, excuse me, still makes sense because every vertex has four edges coming out of it. So the definition of partition function is the same as before. Just to be concrete, though, why don't we write down explicitly what that means? So it's a sort of awful-looking formula. It's helpful to add in some dummy variables. So maybe, I don't know if this green is visible, but let me just add them. So again, the partition function is going to vary all over all values of R, S, and T. So varying, I mean, sort of dummy indices. And same thing here. R. Did I get that right? Don't think it matters too much, but okay. Sorry?
Quick question.
Yes.
So do you mean with this equality, do you mean the partition function of this graph has to be equal to the partition function of this graph?
Yes.
With the partition function that we defined in the last lecture.
That's right. That's right. So we're supposed to sum over all configurations, which really explicitly just means we sum over all R, S, and T, and then we multiply what we see at each vertex, right? So here we see some R something, some R matrix and another one, and same thing on the other side. And sorry, let me follow Kevin's convention so I don't make a mistake. Assuming Kevin didn't make a mistake, which is probably true. Okay, explicitly then, this means something like, so starting at the top left over there, ij rs z3 minus z1 r rk at z3 minus z2. So this first term is counting this contributions here. The next one will be from the intersection of 3 and 2, so that's this vertex. And then we need one for down there. The order we put these in, excuse me, doesn't matter since they are just numbers. So implicitly summing over R, S, and T. So maybe just to be explicit. Usual summation notation, otherwise. And okay, and similar thing for the right hand side. Hopefully, yeah, this is correct. So there's another three terms because there are three vertices again. If I made a mistake, then the diagrams are the right things. So. But
how do we choose the IJKL indices in the HR?
I'm sorry?
How do we choose where to put the indices in the R's?
Oh, it's clearer, I think, if you just erase the indices. So if we took the indices out, right, really what we ultimately want to do is somehow fix the boundary. So it's just saying that sort of the left-hand boundary of the horizontal line must be the same as this one, and so on. So we are going to fix the outer boundary condition somehow. The choice here was just some labels, but whichever one we put, we should exactly copy it on the right-hand side. Is that?
So okay, in this one, the left triangle,
yeah, sorry.
You do the, which one is the up one? The J is the up one, the K is the up one, but what is the up one in the down one?
Thank you. Yes, you're right. Sorry. That's where, maybe just, let me write it here. Thanks, that's a good point. So you should think that sort of the vertical, there's always this orientation which tells you, you know, some handedness rule. So if it's I, J, K, L, I mean, however this is oriented, we should read it that way, so. makes more sense. So, yeah, that's a great point. Hence the arrows. I don't know if they're visible. Everything's sort of pointing down and to the right everywhere. So that's an essential. Maybe my arrows are not very helpful. I don't know. The question is, what's the significance of this? And as some of you may know, the point is that this Yang-Baxter equation kind of guarantees us integrability, or say, it lets us completely solve the system. More on that in a minute, but let's see. Oh, maybe I should say, here's just an example of a solution to this. So you might say, can you actually find a matrix like this which satisfies the Yang-Baxter equation? And here's one. So it's sort of the simplest solution, simplest non-trivial solution. We could just take all of the weights to be zero, right? That's the solution. It's one where basically everything's just a bunch of delta functions. I, k, j, l. But it does have a parameter involved. I, l, delta, j. So this is sometimes called the rational R matrix. Or Yang's R matrix. To my knowledge, Yang found this solution. So, assuming I actually talk fast enough, we'll come back to this one in a minute. So maybe I can say in words, one interesting example that this R matrix is connected to is the XXX spin chain, which is another sort of interesting physical system. So, So there's at least one example. So to say maybe one thing, this thing is just the identity matrix. If you actually think about what that does, if we put in a vector I tensor J, we'll get back K tensor L, if and only if it's the same vector itself. So, whereas this one is the one that actually swaps the two factors. So. Remember, this is going to act on Cn tensor Cn. So this is the identity. This is just swapping. So it's very simple. Maybe in case I don't get there, I will just write. When, when the number of spins is 2, this is related to the XXX spin chain. Assuming I actually talk fast enough, I'll get there. So again, why are we interested in this? The point is that vertex models where the Boltzmann weights have a parameter where the Boltzmann weights depend on a parameter, and they satisfy the Yang-Baxter equation. Yang-Baxter equation are integrable. They can be solved exactly. Which is not a super precise sentence. What's a better way to say it, perhaps, is that you can find sort of a bunch of commuting Hamiltonians, so kind of enough Hamiltonians in the sense of Louisville. Or maybe a better way can find infinitely many conserved currents. Any questions? Okay. So, why is that? Well, they come from the transfer matrices, actually. So, just as before, let me maybe be a little bit more precise. So, okay. Like, just like yesterday, we want to consider, say, horizontal equals time and vertical equals space. We will sort of only put the labels, these parameters z, on the vertical lines. So, okay. So then associated to the picture, say like this one, here's our vertical line, and let's just put a bunch of horizontal stuff. We can write down a transfer matrix, so just as we did before. So summing over the monodromy matrices for this. Is it clear what's meant? So it's sort of some transfer matrix T. The point is all these R matrices involve parameters Z now, but so we can actually make this sort of a function of Z. And this is, again, sort of K lines. So this is going to be some, just like before, some map from Cn tensor K times to itself. And the key fact that makes this all sort of work is, so we're going to assume now that the Young-Baxter equation is satisfied. So sorry, I mean to say we're in this situation where we can exactly solve. So key fact, this Young-Baxter equation implies that, so what if we took two different values of z? We can think of somehow, I mean, I'll make this more precise in a second, but have two different transfer matrices. And we can think of both of them as endomorphisms. Linear operators there, they commute. And this is where the conserved currents come from. It's by sort of doing Taylor expansions of these functions. So.
Does this go the other way around?
Sorry? Oh, I was thinking about this last night. I have some notes from a talk I was at where they said yes, and I think in certain situations that it's equivalent, but I'm hesitant to say exactly. So I think you'd have to be careful about, you know, how things depend on Z exactly, but possibly. You could think that they're somehow close to equivalent, I think.
Is there a physical interpretation to Z?
That's a very good question. So I think in certain situations, for example, we talked briefly yesterday about the six-vertex model. If you impose some constraints on what the Boltzmann weights are, you'll naturally find that the R matrix sort of only depends on sort of very few parameters. So in principle, for the R matrix, you know, we have to choose a number for every configuration around the vertex, right? But in the six-vertex model, we only need six numbers. And if we impose some more constraints, we maybe only need one. And you can think that that's the Z. But I think that there are many other situations where these R matrices occur, where, which I think probably Kevin will be talking about, where it's more natural to have an extra parameter coming in. Maybe some sort of gauge theory, but I can't really say anything about that. So, but that's a really good question. Are there any other questions at the moment? So we're going to prove this, and there's a really beautiful geometric sort of diagrammatic proof, which sort of depends on one extra assumption. So it's an assumption which is probably a natural one, but let me just say. So we'll prove this diagrammatically. But to do so, we'll just add one more assumption, which is here referred to as unitarity. Which is saying that the R matrix is related to its transpose inverse. Namely, we should say, let's see, I, J, K, L of Z, R, L, K, R, S, negative Z, with summation over L and K. So here's sort of multiplying one R matrix with the other, and with a minus, is the identity. So delta I S delta J R. Now it becomes maybe a little bit clearer what this means if we look at a diagram. I'll try to use colors, but let's see how that goes. So this says something like this. So you can consider this double crossing. Again, it's not a grid, I know, but every vertex does have four corners, again, where, say, we're sort of orienting this way. We put a Z1 here, Z1 there, Z2 and Z2. And I won't impose any, I won't say anything about boundary conditions, but like before, let's just tacitly assume stuff like, you know, the boundary condition that's here will be the same as on the right-hand side that I haven't written yet. So, sorry, I should have said this first. This crossing can be sort of undone. All that's really going on here then is that the first crossing is the first R matrix, the second one reflects the second. Now we are using one hypothesis here, which is that the R matrix, remember, had a symmetry at the beginning where you could exchange the indices at the cost of putting in a sign, so we are using that here. But is that clear? So I've put some labels here, right? Here, I J, R, and S are some fixed for, which again will be the same as putting sort of. Whatever they are, I, S, J, R, something like that. But for brevity, we'll just stop writing the boundary conditions because it just becomes too big of a mess. So any questions about that? Hopefully everyone's on the same page at this point. So it's just a sort of algebraic relation here, which is nice to impose. So it lets us undo the crossings. Okay. So. So let's prove that the transfer matrices for two different values commute. Two different values of Z, sorry. P of, I guess I could have called them Z1 and Z2. Anyway, T of Z prime equals zero. Okay. Let me get this right. So first of all, we'll just start with nothing going on. So here's Z and Z prime, and with some number of horizontal lines. Remember, the transfer matrix depends on choosing how many horizontal lines there are. So what do we do? And sorry, this is oriented downwards. At the moment, that's not too important, but will be. So one thing we can do is, we can do this sort of at any point on the strands, but we can use this relation here the opposite way and push this strand over that one. So we can say that this is equal to something like, try and draw this right, this guy, where I'll follow Kevin that this is between the first and second horizontal, but I don't think that's too important. So this is from this unitarity assumption. Now, the other assumption that we have is that the R matrix satisfies the Yang-Baxter equation. And what you can notice is that, remember, that lets you take a triangle and sort of pull the sides around. So here's a triangle with a white edge, an orange edge, and a green edge. So we can pull this white one below. So this is unitarity. Now we can use Yang-Baxter equation. And let's see if I can do this right. I guess it looks basically the same. But right now we've changed where the crossing is. So everything happened here and here. Right? We just slid the white line past the green and orange. But again, Yang-Baxter lets us do that. Make sense? Okay. And if we kind of repeat this Yang-Baxter argument, we can eventually get to the following, sort of something which immediately goes to the right and then left. Green one stays there. And sort of it crossed right away and went down. This is why I say it doesn't matter so much which where you do this initial pull at the unitarity assumption, because either way you can pull things up and down with the Yang-Baxter relation. So again, this is using Yang-Baxter to some power. Okay. Make sense? So this, I mean, and also everything's oriented and labeled and so on. So maybe to be clear, since that's the key one, again, this is sort of downward. This is labeled by Z the whole time, and this is labeled by Z prime. And we're sort of almost done. So what do we actually want is, here we have one transfer matrix. Here we have the next one. And this diagram reflects their product in the one order. So this left-hand side is actually T of Z prime. Again, once we impose boundary conditions everywhere. And what we'd like to do is actually end up with the opposite diagram where the green and white lines are swapped. That would be the product in the other order. And we're almost there. So we just need to remember one important fact, which I've sort of not written on the board anywhere, but remember that the the transfer matrix, at the top and the bottom of the transfer matrix, we didn't actually impose boundary conditions. We just imposed a sort of periodic boundary condition, right? So it was a sum of these transfer matrices where I and J are the same. So you can actually, it's periodic. In other words, you can imagine that this is actually wrapped around, right? So sort of mystifying step, but So it's very critical for this proof anyway. So let me try and draw that somehow. So we have this picture. So I'll say in words, since these involve periodic sort of boundary conditions at top and bottom, you can sort of, again, imagine that this is actually wrapped onto a cylinder. So we can sort of scroll the board back. Maybe if we had paper, we could do it. But so here's our current picture. I forgot the chalk again. So essentially, it's just repeating itself down here, right? And so on. Oops. So again, sort of here I've fictitiously wrapped it, right? So it's just the same picture again. But now you can use unitarity to pull that through, right? So this actually is just equal to, what would end up happening is this strand ends up actually here, and we end up with the white on the other side of the green. So. And so here we've used unitarity. Does that make sense? So again, pull the periodic part through. Of course, we can check all these things algebraically, but you can see that the pictures give a much cleaner, kind of very short proof. It's just some diagrams. Oh, right. Which, of course, is Z prime and Z. This is exactly what we wanted. Oh, did I get the orders wrong before? Sorry, I wrote these in the wrong order. I keep forgetting the composition order, right? The Z one is first, and we're going that way. So actually, this one was this. Sorry. First, we do this transfer matrix, and then we cross the next one. So here we get the opposite. So there's a proof. Okay. So OK, I probably don't have time to do the XXX discussion, but let's just wrap up by talking a little bit about why this is useful. I said it in words before, which is we're going to sort of Taylor expand one of them, say, in powers of Z or Z prime. So if we sort of fix some Z naught, then we could view this T of Z naught, that specific value, as time evolution. Discrete. I should say one more word, which I forgot to write earlier. It's discrete time evolution for the system with periodic boundary conditions at the top and bottom. So then it follows that because of the commutativity, then these other transfer matrices are conserved quantities. So and here we can now just take any Z, and that's sort of the point. So. Mm-hmm. I guess we're pretty close to the end, so we should probably stop there. So this is really useful. For example, as we mentioned, this Yang R matrix, now it's nowhere, is related to XXZ and or XSZ. So if you expand the Yang R matrix, sort of use that to write down a transfer matrix expanded in powers of Z inverse, you get a bunch of operators which commute with the Hamiltonian of XXZ. So you get a whole ton of conserved quantities. I feel bad saying that and not writing it, so try to write that at the beginning of next class. So, any questions before we stop? Yes?
I didn't really understand the last few steps.
Ah, yeah, it is confusing. Right. Well, that's fair. The point is, really, we were looking at this picture up at the top, right? From here on, sort of, or so far we didn't do too much, right? But the point is that T, this operator T is actually it's a matrix, but remember it's actually coming from partition functions of this picture, or sorry, not this picture, but related pictures. And at the very beginning, when we were computing T, we're actually going to do stuff like sum over all I of I up here and I down there. Right. And the point is that this periodicity is why we can think of it as having wrap. So if we sort of fix an I, you could put the I here and here. Now really the results you would compute would be the same as if you sort of cut somewhere else. So as long as we look at one sort of domain of this picture, so if we can sort of simultaneously slide, we would get the same answers. The reason being, again, that the computation of the transfer matrix involves periodic boundary conditions. So for example, you could we could just compute part of T. So we could fix the I's, and we could fix some other things here. And throughout the pictures, then, we would get the same thing. Actually, we probably want the sum. We still have that going on here. J. J's on the green. The point is, if you cut the picture, for example, like here instead, and compute the partition function, you'll get the same thing. Essentially, normally the partition function involves summing over states, or about spin states, excuse me. So yes, we do want the sum. Since we're summing over all I, but having the same top and bottom, all j, same top and bottom, that's actually the same as computing the partition function for something where you could think of wrapping it a little bit. I don't know if that's a helpful answer or not, but yes.
So I mean, I understand what you're doing there, because you know if I take that thing and wrap it around, I can just use locally that linearity.
Yes.
Then you undo that, and then it becomes parallel. But just technical point is, if you were to write it like that, where you're writing it as two copies of it, then it's a very minor point, but technically that is not exactly the T matrix. It's twice that times T matrix or something.
Oh, the way it's currently.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I should have.
But
I shouldn't have two copies of things. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
If I were to roll it on a piece of paper, then I could just do a local.
Exactly. Yeah, you should really think that the transfer matrix to begin with, when we write it down, you can imagine that this picture is rolled onto a cylinder. So it's actually on the outside of the cylinder, and we're actually computing a partition function there. If you look back at the definition of the transfer matrix, because you're having the same values appear here, summed over all of them. But try to think of it that way. So yes, that's exactly a fair point. Here I've written too much, right? There's really only one cylinder. I'm just drawing it kind of rolled out. As it would roll down the real line.